All right, and welcome everyone. Another Cancel the Cabal on peoplesinternetradio.com and Revolution Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts, and I do want to welcome back for the second time, Wal Thornhill. Welcome, Wal. I'm going to put your bio in at a later time, so we're going to go into discussing some things. We'll probably do about an hour this time, you think?
Yes.
All right, that'll be fine with me. I don't really want to hold you much longer than that. You're very busy, and I have plenty of things to do myself, but we were talking before we started to go live here that we're going to talk about social issues more than scientific. I think they're probably going to interact with each other, though. But yeah, you said your biggest file on your computer was what? I'm sorry, remind me.
The sociology of science
file. Sociology of science. Yeah. What would somebody that doesn't really understand that, how would you explain that to someone?
Well, the sociology of science is the way that science is done, both between scientists and between scientists and the public. And it's a fascinating study, but it's one which most physicists, I would suggest, have either not been taught or don't pay any attention to. Because the emphasis there is just to get all these facts into your head and then go out there and tell others. When the public start rebelling, of course, then it's a war on science. and it's all of the attacks and counterattacks which make up quite a large part of this this folder on sociology of science.
Well, it seems to me what you've kind of described there, maybe you can enlighten me a little bit, but isn't it sort of like the religious view versus the scientific view of the, 12th or 13th century? Or
that's the kind of thing, yes. The problem, or one of the big problems, is that scientists believe that science is divorced from religion, but that's not so. It's something that they tell everyone. But when you examine what they do and how they do it, you realize that our present Big Bang cosmology is merely a restatement of Western religion, replete with mathematical formulae all over the blackboard. It's rather like the Latin Mass, where the people didn't necessarily understand what was being said, but it was impressive. And and for that reason alone, and also for the fact that people are desperate, or when I say desperate, want to know more about why we are here and what's it all about, then any show of power and glory, as they say, is certain to gain your attention and also produce converts, even without any real understanding. And this is the case in science too. We have this cosmology, which has become another belief system, and yet the understanding at its very heart is not there. There is no understanding of gravity, and yet that forms the basis of the Big Bang cosmology. There's no understanding of how matter can be created, and yet we need that to produce the universe in the first place. So right at the very foundations, we have beliefs rather than actual science. And of course, because cosmology is supposed to be the umbrella science for all others, it means that the very underpinnings of all of our sciences is missing, which is a bit of a wake-up call.
How big of a mystery is gravity?
Oh, it's huge. The very fact that cosmologists have had to invent dark matter, black holes, and now dark energy suggests that this ad hoc addition to theory, repeated ad hoc additions to theory, means that the basic theory itself is incorrect. I mean, this is a normal symptom of having an invalid theory in the first place. And what you should do then is you go back to the drawing board. And how often have we heard over the last century, it's back to the drawing board, because the discoveries we have now throw everything that we thought we knew out the window.
Okay.
And what happens? They go back to the drawing board and they do not rub anything off. They just add things to it so that it becomes a greater mess. And currently, I would suggest cosmology is one huge mess.
Your indication or your characterization of ad hoc science of a couple of minutes ago, does that indicate that maybe they're making stuff up as they go along? Or
One of the big difficulties in modern physics is that it's been taken over by mathematicians, and they've promulgated this view that to prove something's true or false, you need to use mathematics. But that's not so. Mathematical logic does not necessarily have anything to do with the real world. And this is something that even Einstein himself pointed out, but people just choose to ignore. Because the fundamental problem with mathematics is that if it's to have any real meaning, you have to be able to define every symbol on the board, and that includes the operators like equals and multiply and divide and so on, just the simple things like that. And yet, as I've pointed out many times in recent years, E equals mc squared is not understood because energy is undefined in real terms. It's always, if you look up an encyclopedia, it talks about energy is conserved. It can be changed from one form to another, but it can never be lost. But it doesn't say what energy is in the first place. And the same with mass. And I have books on my shelf by philosophers who pointed out that no one has defined mass in terms of matter. And yet the encyclopedias and textbooks confuse mass with matter or quantity of matter. Just by the very words they use a few paragraphs after having said, mass, or tried to define mass in terms of the quantity of matter, they start using the word matter and mass interchangeably. They are not interchangeable. Mass is a property of matter. So you must be specific. You're either talking about matter or you're talking about mass. You can't use the word interchangeably. And yet they do. Also, E equals mc squared has got the speed of light in there. The speed of light with respect to what? Well, according to Einstein, it's an arbitrary observer. He invented these inertial frames of reference, and they're all equivalent. Well, that's nonsense. They can't be equivalent because the way you are moving has an effect. For instance, if you're spinning and you've got a bucket of water there, the water tries to rise up the walls of the bucket. And yet another observer who's not spinning and some distance away will not have that effect at all. So the two frames of reference depend on how you are moving. And then you've got to say, well, moving with respect to what? Well, the classical physicists knew that it had to be with respect to the fixed stars, as they called it. In other words, some universal reference frame. But Einstein got rid of that, and in doing so, he stopped doing physics. And everyone since who's followed him has stopped doing physics because physics requires absolute measurements. Otherwise, you're not doing physics. So these are the kinds of things that we should be challenging students with when they're doing science, to get them to think carefully about what it is they're writing on their piece of paper and the conclusions they're drawing from the operations they perform, their mathematical operations. At present, it's a case of learn this, and we don't understand. If you ask deep questions, you'll get answers which you feel on the surface don't make any sense, but, experts must be right. These people have been doing it all their lives. You have to get rid of that idea. Mankind, our strongest, our real forte, so to speak, is self-delusion. And once you realize that, then you can try and do something to minimize it. But at present, there's no attempt. So people who write science articles now, the more science fiction-like they can make it sound, the better publicity it is, and it also then may attract attention and money. And, of course, money is the big thing, the funding. Anyone who gets up and says, those trillions of dollars you're spending on that experiment are wasted because you don't understand what you're doing, is not going to be listened to. And yet there are a growing number of scientists doing just that.
Yeah.
And also not being paid attention to.
Well, and they're written, and then we get back into the conspiracy that we spoke of and the first show. Well, that academia that entertains conspiracy loses their government funding.
Yes, yes. Well, the problem is I think that politicians in general don't know science. I mean, they've probably never done it except in a cursory way at high school. And so they rely on scientists for advice. But then you have the problem in science that it's fragmented. You have all of these disciplines. And each discipline, because of the narrowness of training these days, even within a single discipline, I've been to meetings where an expert in one particular region of that discipline has to explain to his colleagues what the heck it is he does, because they don't understand what he's doing anyway.
Right.
So you get this problem of experts misleading other experts with the or the degree to which they are certain or can prove what they're saying is correct. So you get this, it's almost like Chinese whispers, where you get misinterpretations, false information from other experts, and the result is a total mishmash at the end. And at the same time, though, you also have this problem of the way scientists are taught. And it is in such a way that they are actually blind to the alternatives. You know, they get results that don't agree with what they expect, and they're just as likely to be discarded as to be published because it's the way the brain functions, unfortunately. A human brain is not an ideal instrument for doing science. And until you understand that and understand how to minimize that problem as well, progress is very slow.
Well, maybe I'm wrong here, but aren't people, and it's not just science, it can be any curriculum, aren't they taught today not to challenge the professors or the teacher?
Well, it's very counterproductive generally, unless you have an outstanding teacher. Outstanding teachers and scientists know their limitations and have taken the trouble to consider that when they give an answer, and also to listen to somebody if they are arguing against what it is you're trying to tell them. Most academics, in my experience, when I've challenged them with ideas that are slightly off their map, get hostile, or they walk away, don't answer, or alternatively, they answer a question that they can answer but has nothing to do with what I just asked.
Okay.
So there's all sorts of avoidance and denial that goes on. And this is a normal human response. But scientists want us to believe that they're inhuman, they're beyond human, that what they do is so well done and so well tested that we shouldn't question them. And that's not the case.
Okay. Maybe I should rephrase that question. Not so much taught not to challenge their professor or teacher, but conditioned. As you just mentioned,
yes.
I've had it in my studies, actually. Professors don't like to be challenged, and they become hostile.
Mm.
Is that because they're narcissists, or is that because they just believe they're right?
No, I think a lot of people stay in school, so to speak, all their lives. In other words, they become academics. That is their ego is built around their ability to pass exams, get all sorts of qualifications and letters after their name. And because the ego is attached to it, it means that any challenge to what they say is taken as a personal assault rather than a question.
I see.
And that's the problem. Yeah. Also, the way we teach science today to students and academics is one that reinforces the left hemisphere. And I've spoken about this maybe before. Dr. Ian McGilchrist is a classic scholar, a psychologist. He's done amazing things in England and is beginning to get some recognition for his work. And he did something which was sort of frowned upon and that is looked at the left right brain research and did a meta-analysis of that research and found that there were distinct differences between the operation of the right and the left hemisphere of the brain. And I found that fascinating because it seems, according to his research, and it's also been shown, I actually sent him a paper which did MRI scans of people who were asked physics questions to see what part of the brain lit up. And would you believe it was the left hemisphere, which is precisely what this Dr. McGilchrist was saying. The left hemisphere is one that has narrow focus and is based on survival. He gives the analogy of a chicken. He says all animals, and it's never been explained why, have this split brain. And, of course, nature doesn't do anything for no reason. It seems the left brain is left hemisphere is aimed at survival. So it looks after automatic responses like feeding, where do I find food, how do I get it, and so on. And if you're trying to escape from something, how do I get out of here? The right hemisphere, on the other hand, as he said, is the chicken's way of avoiding being someone else's lunch. It's the one that has the broader view, and it inhibits the overreaction of the left hemisphere. Now, what we do in schools is we just train kids. These are the facts. This is what you need. This is the roadmap. This is all left hemisphere stuff. And sure enough, the MRI scans showed that this is what happens. The right hemisphere is the one that has the more philosophical approach, looks at the broad picture and says, is the left hemisphere making any sense here? And there are plenty of examples he gives of research on patients who've had left or right hemisphere damage or some problem with the corpus callosum, the connection between left and right. But the significant thing in all that research is that he found that this connection between left and right hemispheres is about inhibition. One hemisphere inhibits the other. And the right hemisphere is important for inhibition because it's the one that really gives us our higher faculties, if you like. It's the one that controls the knee-jerk responses of the left hemisphere. So once again, if you ask a professor a question that is appears to him or her to be a challenge to their way of thinking, the knee-jerk response is to be hostile. The more reasoned right hemisphere approach is to think about it. Don't go into a knee-jerk reaction. Think about it. Is there a possibility that this is something I should look at more closely? Does it deserve a reasoned answer? This kind of thing. So we're just not training people to be scientists. In the old days, of course, a scientist was trained in the classics and all kinds of things. It was a much more wide-ranging education. And I think the fact that we now focus more and more narrowly has produced people who are functionally not actually suited for the job, particularly theoretical physicists who are trying to make sense of the big picture. Their big picture just isn't big enough.
Well, I find it interesting. I haven't studied a lot of sociology or psychology or anything like that, but I have, I've just dabbled in it myself, and I find it interesting why people have a narcissistic view on being challenged on something. A little short story. When I was in college, I did challenge a history professor in the syllabus, the curriculum, on what the true historical facts were about about World War II. I believe that there is suppressed evidence out there that would indicate that Japan was trying to surrender quite early as 8 months before the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
They were going through back channels on quite a few different countries' embassies, trying to reach out to Britain and Russia and the U.S. trying to surrender, and they were being pushed to the side. They were being told, forget about it. We're not going to take your surrender. We will more or less take your surrender on our terms. That was after the two bombs were dropped.
Yes.
And this particular professor wasn't going to hear any of that because it wasn't in his syllabus. Mm. It wasn't in the his particular history book.
Yeah. But it's perfectly understandable as a possibility because we know politicians, we never know quite what agenda they have in mind when they give their responses to something. I know we've just seen a film called United Kingdom, which gives a very interesting example of that in terms of the two-faced behavior of the British government. I think people know that at some level, but they always hope for the best. They always hope that people are responding to them in a reasonable way and truthfully. So I think it's valid to ask these questions because we know that just it's not the way the world works.
Yeah. It's been said today that children aren't actually learning a whole lot. They're just being taught how to repeat what's been given to them.
That's right. Yes. There's another friend. It's interesting, you know, one of the encouraging aspects of the Electric Universe work is that because we're networking more broadly every year, we have well-qualified people who look at what we're doing and say, yes, this makes sense. And then they think, hang on a minute, my subject, I can use this in what I'm doing. And so we've had people from all sorts of disciplines involved. And I think this is great because, as I said, cosmology is supposed to be an umbrella science. It can't divorce itself from the nitty-gritties of other disciplines at all. It has to make sense right across the board. Otherwise, it's not complete, or it may be completely wrong. Anyway, I had a contact from an educational psychologist in South Australia. And he has corresponded with me and we've met, and he's doing good work in what he calls remedial mediation. Because he said, when students have been brought up to think in a particular way or to do something in a particular way, which is incorrect, to try and get them to change and to learn to do it the correct way is hard work. And so what they do is they've got a program which is actually being implemented in schools in South Australia now, I'm pleased to say, where they confront the students with the right way and the wrong way, and they get them to give their reasons why one is better than the other. They have to think about it, for instance. That's the main thing. But the psychologists have found they have to do this repeatedly before it actually makes any difference. So you can see that how we train kids initially is very important, because if we do it wrongly, it's very hard to change afterwards. And yet this is really necessary. If you're going to make a paradigm shift, a big breakthrough in science, you have to be prepared to change, and change without too much pain and drama. And those who can do that will be the ones who will succeed most when it comes to the science of the future. But he also pointed out that the way kids are taught these days, it's a case of cramming it in, passing the exam, and then it's quickly forgotten. There's no reinforcement that comes after it. And also people find it difficult, science difficult to learn in general. I mean, some people love it, but despite all of the the failings of the system. But even so, even those who love it, they're still being trained in a way which mitigates against them being able to listen to a confronting new idea, one which says this is a better way compared with the old way.
Well, I think unless someone has a natural talent for retaining what they believe, retaining what they've learned, or otherwise, if they're just a savant. In other words, I think someone needs to have repetitiveness to do it over and over, or read it over and over and over again to retain it.
Yes. That was a feature of our training when we were going through school, which is many decades ago now. It was repetitive. Some of it was sing-song, you know, but it's that kind of repetitiveness which does mean that you remember it. But I think in the case of the Electric Universe, it's my view that you can begin teaching it very early because it is a big picture. You can just paint the big picture without going into any detail at all, and then as they progress, give them more and more bits of the picture so that it all becomes clearer. At present, they tend to keep things secret from you until you get to certain levels in high school or university, and then they reveal these miracles. I remember the feeling when I was at school. I couldn't wait until we did calculus, and then I couldn't wait until we did nuclear physics or something like that at university. It shouldn't be like that. The groundwork should be set early, and for those who are curious, they will learn themselves, and the best lessons of all are the ones that you teach yourself, and also the ones where you make mistakes and you learn from your mistakes. Those ones you never forget. But just learning things by rote is not sufficient on its own, and also it doesn't allow for comparisons. Now, that's the other aspect that I think is very important in science. The history of science is taught like a kind of, you know, it's almost trivial, and it's given like a kind of Darwinian progression from, you know, ignorance up to our pinnacle of understanding now, where we can tell you how the universe was formed. It's bullshit. What you need to do for science to progress, and for people when they go back to the drawing board to actually rub the stuff off it and start again, is to understand the arguments that went on in the past between all of the leading figures at the time about things that are really important, like Einstein's work, for instance. If you go back and read the arguments against Einstein's work, you wonder how on earth he ever gained traction. So what do? You do a little more investigation. You find out the political environment at the time and the status of the leading figures and their political clout and all of this kind of thing. It had nothing to do with real science. It was all about influence and a show of hands, which is not scientific. I mean, it's not a democracy in science. It's a case of who's right and who's wrong. And because we do things in this sort of slapdash and haphazard way, science progresses far more slowly than it could. And also, people are turned off science because they can't see the relevance. They can't see the big picture from an early stage and see where they fit in. It's important that the individual understands how they fit into this big picture and find their own place, the thing that turns them on. What do I want to do? How do I want to contribute? Because that's the thing that really generates real understanding and real involvement.
Isn't that a cognitive dissonance way of thinking, overriding their conditioned religious view, maybe?
That's right. We are brought up and taught in such a way that it generates a roadmap, if you like, in our mind. This roadmap gives us our place, you know, our street address, if you like. And to get from A to B, you have to follow these rules and so on. But the roadmap is extremely limited, and also it's one which is handed down in such a way that it's very hard to shift it, get rid of it, you know, start again. And as I said, this comes down to this business of going back to the drawing board and wiping it clean. Yeah. It's scary. You know, it's like losing sight of land in a boat or something. You have to really take the initiative and start thinking for yourself.
Is there a great struggle between the mainstream science, which is controlled and has an agenda, with the alternative science? Is there a great struggle? Are there a lot of scientists that are turning to an alternative view?
A lot of scientists are publishing in journals which are not the big ones, you know, the so-called accepted journals.
Authorized, accepted,
because
yes.
Because the censorship system of anonymous peer review shuts down real challenges. I mean, I could not publish anything in a scientific journal which said that we have no understanding of gravity. Because immediately I get hit with, what about Einstein's theory of general relativity and so on? Well, as I pointed out a little while ago, Einstein's theory of relativity fails at first base, and general relativity is built on special relativity. So, you know, the foundations are missing. But no one wants to know that. I mean, that would be that's such a radical change that it's not going to be accepted. So the only way is to, from my point of view anyway, is to allow the general public, as many as are curious, to know that there is an alternative story. It's much simpler. It's an amazing story, and one which people with no scientific training can get involved in at various levels, simply because they've, for the first time, can see their, what they can contribute. And this is happening, of course. This is happening. The question in my mind is, in what year am I likely, or am I ever, to see mainstream media pick this up? Because the funny thing is, the story we have to tell is more interesting and fascinating than any science fiction or real story, true story ever published. It's just incredible. And you would have thought that the filmmakers and the scientific journals and that would jump at the opportunity to have published or be the first to publish the next big paradigm shift and the story of the humanity and the Earth, which is nothing like the fairy story we're taught, and which is just, you know, it is amazing.
Who's leading that charge? Are you, or is your group?
It's an interesting question. It seems when I look back over my path through life that I was actually destined to do what I'm doing, and knowing what your life's purpose is a powerful force.
I think I am too.
Yeah. So the main impetus for getting this out to the public came when I joined up with Dave Talbot in 1994. We first met in 1974 at a conference in Canada, and then I didn't know what he was up to, and I don't think he knew of my deep interest in the problems thrown up by Velikovsky's work uncovering planetary disturbances in the solar system within the memory of mankind. And I was interested in the physics. How could we explain what was being discovered? And then Dave Talbot's work threw even more difficulties in my path, because he was suggesting configurations of planets which are completely outside anything that Newtonian physics could explain, which suggested that Newton only got the picture of gravity right so far as he could observe on Earth. And that was as far as it went. He himself said he didn't understand it. All he did was write an equation which showed how it works on Earth. But the mathematicians, of course, they love certainty. So they took that equation and applied it throughout the universe. And, of course, it doesn't work. Surprise, surprise. This is one other lesson we haven't learnt of geocentricity of thinking. You know, the Earth is the center of the universe. It's not. It's a part of an amazing universe of unknown extent and age, and we have to come to terms with that. Anyway, that was a side issue. Getting back to that meeting in 1994 with Dave Talbot, I saw his work presented graphically there for the first time. And afterwards, I went up to him and I said, you might not remember we met in 1974, but I said, I think your work and mine is more powerful if it's brought together, if there's convergence between the two, because his story is very important for mankind's understanding of ourselves and our history and why we behave in the strange ways we do, the sort of post-traumatic stress disorder of the entire human race, you might say, having faced a doomsday event, which we thought the Earth and us were history. There's that side of the story, but what he was describing required a new science, an understanding of gravity to be able to explain it. And it took me up until just a couple of years ago to finally put all the pieces of the puzzle together. But the challenges in doing that were enormous. At each step, I had to throw away things which I thought were a dead certainty. You know, the scientists had got it right. And then I was confronted with this issue time and time again. Like, for instance, Einstein, it was hard to throw that away because I thought, well, people are going to just dismiss me out of hand because I've challenged Einstein. Well, you've got to do these things. Otherwise, science stays where it's, you know, back in the 1920s.
Now you really got me thinking and interested. I just found Red Ice Radio, David Talbot.
Yes.
Hour one. Mm. It says David is a comparative mythologist. Can you explain what that is? Comparative mythology?
Yes. Yes. It's something that Velikovsky taught us, and it taught me when I was a teenager, because that's when I first read his book. It taught me a forensic style of looking at evidence. You can treat the stories from all of the ancient cultures in a that from unreliable witnesses of some event, like, you know, bank robbery. And the people who witnessed it all give you, they say there was a bank robbery occurred, and but they all give slightly different descriptions. But there's one description that seems to ring true, because one person says he was wearing odd socks, and one says, oh, he had one red sock and one green sock.
A pattern?
That's the kind of evidence that you can take to the bank, as Dave Talbot puts it.
A pattern?
That the person was wearing odd socks.
Okay.
Well, what you do is you look at all these myths and legends, and you see their stories of heroes and damsels in distress and all of the archetypes of the story of King Arthur and whatnot. And you see it's repeated. It's repeated all around the world. The South Sea Islanders, the Eskimos, the Bushmen of Africa, the Australian Aborigines. They all have the same archetypes. And so Dave Talbot extended Velikovsky's work, which just dealt with mostly with the biblical and Middle Eastern references to the planetary gods and so on. And he said that a clue, I mean, Velikovsky gave clues which were valuable, but David Talbot and Eduardo Cardona, who sadly passed away just recently, have published an awful lot of work, and it agrees, you know, very closely that there was a linear arrangement of planets in the past. And, of course, that's under orbital mechanics, that's impossible. But what we had to realize was that this was not an orbital system. It was a capture system. It was a system being captured, one star by another. And we were part of another star system. Now, all of this sounds completely outrageous, but once you've pieced together what the ancients were desperate for us to understand, and stop just considering it as being poetic allegory and that kind of thing. And when they talked about thunderbolts of the gods, they didn't mean the little sparks that we call lightning. There was something far more powerful, but it's something that we've now witnessed in high-energy labs, in electrical engineering labs. So the ancients, it can be shown that what they were trying to tell us had a basis in fact. Well, all of that meant that I then needed a more detailed understanding of gravity to be able to suggest how this might have worked. And having done that, the whole thing opens up science to real interdisciplinary investigation, not the sort of token interdisciplinary collaboration you get these days. This means everything, you know. The soft sciences, the cultural aspects, everything is all part of this cosmology. As nothing is left untouched. And that is of huge significance because, as I said earlier, we were talking about this doomsday fear of mankind and our irrational response to it can be destructive. In other words, we try and repeat the doomsday experience. And this is known in psychiatric terms too, as a response to amnesia, a forgetting of a ghastly event that you cannot bring to mind consciously, but you sort of reenact in some strange way. And our warlike behavior is just that. It's insane behavior. It's got nothing to do with rationality at all. And also we go flying the flags of the old planetary gods and waving the spears and, you know, firearms of Mars, the god of war. We don't even know what we're doing. It is purely irrational. But until we understand it, we will not heal from it. And so this throws our future into great doubt until we can actually embrace the science of the 21st century, which involves an understanding of the electric universe and our real history, which involves the electric thunderbolts of the gods and their apocalyptic effect on humankind.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Wal, because if you remember, quite a few months ago now, I did pass you a video that a friend of mine over there in Ireland, Van Byrne, he's a amateur scientist himself, and he happened to notice on Google Earth a lot of anomalies, and he put forth the idea that possibly it was planetary electricity or planetary thunderbolts that might have passed from one planet to another.
Yes.
I want to get your thoughts on what he put in that video, if you happen to remember it.
I don't remember the specifics, but there are a number of people whose particular interest in our work on the thunderbolts.info website. There's a forum there, and some of the people on that forum have actually set up their own garage experiments to reproduce the landforms that you see on Mars in particular and Earth electrically. And they're doing it, having great success. And what it means for geology is that the old idea that you can explain the features of the Earth, the mountain ranges, the ocean basins, the salty water oceans, and so on, just in terms of a theory which goes back 4.5 billion years and is a slow, gradual process, apart from the occasional collision of with an asteroid or something, it's just a fairy story, because the ancients actually witnessed planetary scarring.
Yes. Yes.
The best example is that huge scar of Mars, which stretches for a third of the way around the planet and has umpteen million cubic kilometers of rock has just been ripped out of it. And a lot of it was hurled into space, and some of it was thrown all around the planet. That's why the early Mars landers showed rocks strewn horizon to horizon, jagged rocks. You know, they weren't eroded. And also, we're still receiving Martian meteorites on Earth.
Yes, yes.
So the ancients witnessed that. And the North American Indians, for instance, had a name for Mars. He was called Scarface.
Okay, okay, yeah.
And there are other stories, too, about Mars being scarred, or his alter egos in Greek myth and so on, you know, Achilles being struck in his heel and so on. The anthropomorphizing of the planetary gods and bringing them down to Earth and instituting kingship and all this sort of thing is all associated with planet worship initially, the origin of religions and so on. And when you understand these things, you can admire our creativity and enjoy it, but you are not tied to it. You are not bound by the bonds of the past, as Velikovsky put it. Right now, we are bound by the past, but we don't understand it. And the way forward, both culturally and scientifically, is to understand that, come to terms with it, and that sets you free. And we need to be set free from this dreadful, cyclical madness that we exhibit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, without going back and listening to it right now, I have watched it like 3 times now, but I believe the the premise of his video is a lot of the mountain ranges that you just mentioned all over the planet are electrical scarring, and they are, well, they...
Oh, yes.
He puts forth the idea that they look like electrical arcing.
Yes.
And his also his theory is also that there was a time that when this happened, mankind, most of mankind had some sort of a just amnesic effect to it. Maybe this arcing effect, or maybe this arcing did that to man, because I believe he puts the idea out there, and I've actually heard this idea from others too, that the South Americans, the indigenous people, I think it might have been the Mayans, or maybe it was the people after the Mayans. They were asked when Spanish came and the English came where these great monuments came from. And they allegedly said, we don't know. They were just here. We don't know where they came from. Like,
yes.
Maybe they knew at one time, but there was some sort of a event that made them forget.
I think mankind was decimated, of course, in the process of all this. Some places were completely obliterated and others survived. And that tended to lead to this them and us type of behavior of mankind, you know. It was because of the bad behavior of those people over there that the gods did this to us, kind of thing, this judgmental aspect of many religions, and also nations, you know, one nation against another. When we realize that we're all part of the same thing and we're all connected, hopefully this kind of division can be laid to rest, but it may take a long time. The scarring was remembered. The Australian Aborigines, for instance, have their stories of how landforms were generated by the rainbow serpent. The rainbow serpent was a reference to an archetypal comet form. A comet form is one where a planet is moving or an object is moving eccentrically about a central star. And because it's an electrical system, it's moving in and out of regions of different charge density and voltage, if you like. And in doing so, it causes that object to discharge, and the discharge takes the form of a comet's display. Now, the Australian Aborigines, actually the language and so on that they use is quite precise. And it doesn't beat about the bush, and it says, you know, these lakes and water holes were formed by where the rainbow snake came down, and this mountain range and so on was caused at the same time. And all of the evidence, when looked at from this point of view, from an electrical point of view, makes sense. And now we've got people, as I said, in their garages performing experiments showing that, yes, they can produce those forms in a simple garage experiment. And this is another aspect that I really enjoy. It throws science back to individuals rather than these huge organizations. It's like trying to turn the Titanic around, trying to change the mind of or the path or direction of a large organization. But individuals, of course, can do it overnight. And so these guys are making discoveries and so on without all of these millions of dollars and huge organizations and government funding. And it's wonderful. This is the way science was done back, you know, in the 1800s and early 1900s.
Yeah, idea, debate back and forth, and then counterpoint, right?
Yeah, when you read the Nature Journal, for instance, which is one of the top science journals at the end of the 1800s, the freewheeling nature of the letters to the editor and so on, and also discussions which were published, are just wonderful. You know, you get the feeling that you could write about anything you wanted to and give any opinion you liked and it would be published. Nowadays, there's no way.
Certainly.
You can be, if you give a challenge, and I've got many examples of this, there's a couple of recent ones, you can send a challenge which seems clear, logical, and unassailable to a journal which is devoted to that topic, and they will not publish it. They'll say, try elsewhere. Try to deflect it at first and hope that it doesn't appear anywhere, but they won't publish it in that journal which is devoted to that subject. And yet you challenge them with a basic, something which would undermine all of the other papers that are in it. And, of course, they don't want to know. I had a friend of Steve Crothers who spoke at a conference on black holes, I think it was, in Europe. And he was invited to speak, and he spoke quite early. And he was more or less sent to Coventry. No one wanted to talk to him, and all the papers that came afterwards made no reference at all to the fact that he just destroyed the foundations of black hole theory. So, this is where the psychology and the sociology of science is important. People have to know that this goes on, and then ask the big questions. What are we paying these people for if they won't address issues which are unpalatable, but possibly game-changing?
Well, I have this theory. Maybe it's just my harebrained the way it works. I don't know. I think there's a lot of people that want to trust the government, and they do believe in government and mainstream science and media, but they know there's something wrong. They just don't want to speak up or say anything for fear of ridicule. I think
yes, that's a strong
I think the science community and the just the researching community in general, they a lot of them fear ridicule, and they don't want to speak up, but. I myself am not really like that. I tend to speak up whether I'm ridiculed or not.
Yeah. This is one thing that I've noticed in my career, is that it pays to look at those areas of science where there's a lot of heat and very little light being generated by the argument. Because the heat usually means that there's an irritant there, which they can't answer.
Yes. Yes.
There's a question they're unable to answer, and that generates hostility.
Yes. That's what I try to tell a lot of people. Well, if you ask a tough question of a politician or a scientist or something like that, a scientist in your case, and you don't get an answer, you get some sort of an attack. That would make me question. Being a outside observer. That would make sure.
That's not the scientific method that they advertise.
Yes.
Of course, the general public doesn't know that the scientific method is just used as a mantra, and there's about as many different scientific methods as there are scientists. And as recent papers that have been published looking at the use of statistics as a means of determining who's right and who's wrong shows, they can't even do the statistics properly. So that you end up with arguments which suggest that a particular idea is correct or has more virtue than some other one. And when you look at the statistics, they've chosen the way they've presented them in such a way that it gives either a misleading impression or it's completely the reverse. Yes. This happened with Halton Arp and his work on quasars. And the only paper I've seen against it uses a statistical technique which avoids doing what Halton Arp did, and that was actually observe the objects that we're talking about, or he was talking about, and just takes a statistical approach to the numbers in the sky relative to active galaxies and so on. Now, that is not the technique that Halton Arp used, and he was backed up by Fred Hoyle, Sir Fred Hoyle, and the Burbages, all leading astronomers, who looked at his observational work and said the chances against him being wrong are millions to one. And yet here we have one paper which, if ever you quote Halton Arp, an amazing astronomer and a pioneer, actually, one of the pioneers of the electric universe, as it turns out, you just realize that it was a hatchet job.
Yes, indeed. I was trying to think of the man's name, and it escapes me now. He was one of the most famous Egyptologists of the last 30 years. He's done a lot of the documentaries that you see on the History Channel and the, Zahi Hawass. That's his name.
Oh, yeah.
Zahi Hawass. I seen a debate. Well, it was a very, very short video because it was going to be a debate between Hawass and Graham Hancock.
Yes.
But all Hawass would do was he was hurling insults.
Yes.
David.
Yes. He's an arrogant sod.
David begged him to come back and he said, come on and have an honest debate with me. Don't just hurl ad hominem attacks. Yeah. And he just, he wouldn't do it. He walked off the stage and he was calling him all sorts of names.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, because he is the expert, of course.
Exactly.
And this attitude is, it should disqualify you from being called a scientist. It's the exact opposite.
Well, well, we're pretty much about almost 57 minutes here. We've almost got an hour. Uh-huh. So.
Okay. Well, I just hope that our Electric Universe 2017 conference is even bigger and better than last year's, which was fantastic. And also that our experiment in Toronto begins to produce results, which we can use to bring about the changes needed.
And where's the conference going to be held?
It'll be held at the same place as last year in Phoenix, Arizona. And the details will be placed on the thunderbolts.info website very shortly, I imagine.
Well, I very much appreciate you coming back on again and hope to talk to you very, very soon.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Steve.
You're very welcome. I could you're one of the people, along with David Yurth over there in Utah, I could speak on a daily basis if the two of you would allow me to.
Okay.
All right. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.